symbol of excellence in sports entertainment.
Hey, hey, it's Conrad Thompson, and you're listening to Insiders right here on Ad Free Shows. And today we're going very inside. A real insider from the days of World Championship Wrestling is joining us today. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Dick Cheatham. Mr. Cheatham, how are you, sir?
Hello, doing great, Conrad. How are you?
Man, better than I deserve. So excited to be with you today. We've had a little bit of time to catch up this morning and just get acquainted, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate all the time and how excited I am about our conversation this morning.
Oh, me too. I'm having a ball. I wish I'd met you before this.
Well, I have a feeling we'll be seeing more of each other. Let me start at the beginning before we talk about WCW. Did you grow up a wrestling fan, and what did you grow up watching, and what part of the world? And just tell us your sort of backstory.
Yeah, look, a little bit like what your background. I'm from Dothan, Alabama.
Okay.
Right down the way from you.
Yes, sir.
And when I grew up, I'd spend my Saturday nights at the Houston County Farm Center, because that's where Wiregrass Wrestling was.
Absolutely.
I was out there every Saturday night. You know, it was a kick. The bad guys in those days. I used to talk with Ole about this a lot. He always asked me, "How do you know Mario Galento?" I said, "Mario was the chief heel we had down in South Alabama."
Oh yeah,
and so I knew I followed it. Hell, I liked it, and I have to tell you, I was pretty much a mark.
Well, we all were, yeah.
So and I hate to admit this, but I still am.
Oh yeah, look behind me. Come on.
But I love going out there on the dirt floors of the Wiregrass Farm Center. Houston County Farm Center had dirt floors back then, and the ring out there in the middle of us. That was where I.
But it was a who's who that came through there. I mean, from Hulk Hogan to Andre the Giant. I mean, everybody wrestled on those dirt floors in Dothan. Everybody.
Yeah, yeah. That was, where they wrestle now is in the Civic Center down there.
That's right. Now.
And you know, it's funny. I used to, when I'd go down to Dothan to visit my parents, I'd always take my dad out there. I always take my dad out there to because he, like most guys that age and grew up in the South, they want to go. And my dad would be on that front row hollering. In fact, Orndorff was pretty funny because he had us on the front row down there, and we were wearing our Paula T-shirts. Do you remember?
Oh, Paula? I do. Yeah, absolutely.
And I've been trying. I talked to his kid, and I said, "I know I've got. I don't throw anything away. I've got those shirts around here somewhere. I'll find one and get them to you because there weren't many,
right?
But I loved them, and my dad was so proud of that because we were on the front row screaming for Paul, and when he came out, he came around. That started a whole deal between me and Orndorff, and that was who could crack who up, and that was the beginning of that with the Paula shirts. And Dad had Dad at that point worked in that building. He was had a personnel guy to admit that for the city of Dothan in his retirement from the military, but yeah, that was. That was those days. I found that building is still up because it was in pretty bad shape the last time I saw it. But the old Civic Center, that you could probably get 5,000 people in there.
Yeah, I think they're still running. I think WWE, as we're talking now, is going to be running there in the next couple of weeks.
No kidding.
Yeah. So listen, let's fast forward. How in the world do you join the Turner organization? Like growing up as a young man in South Alabama, how do you find yourself going to work for Turner and what capacity and all that?
Well, yeah, it's an odd kind of sideways deal, but I had worked, I've been a number jockey forever. And the reason I wrong as a young man, but I saw accounting as being a pure form of business. I know that's silly, but I said, you're bound by rules that don't allow you to lie, you know, that kind of stuff. I went to work in banking and in accounting, in banking. This almost sounds like that. How do you stay out of trouble? You do the closest thing to honest. It's like the other guys, that movie, The Other Guys, where Will Ferrell is the forensic cop.
Yes. You know? Yes.
And the idea was how far away from trouble can you get? Well, I'm going to be an accountant inside banking, you know. So, well, I stayed in there for a while, I like the business. And I ended up running across Jack Zimmerman. He's the guy that I worked for on four different occasions. He was, when I first met him, he was the controller for First Atlanta. And I liked him because he had been I looked at his background. He'd been on the Financial Accounting Standards Board when he was worked for Price Waterhouse. I mean, he was like pure. He's the silver bullet of accounting, you know. And I liked him. And I had a couple of common hobbies. We were both photographers. And so we got to know each other over the next 40 years, I guess. After he left First Atlanta, he got mixed up with a guy named Richard Kessler. Kessler was Day's End guy.
Okay.
And in fact, he ended up, when Cecil Day died, he ended up working out a deal where he got not controlling interest, but a significant interest in Day's End. And the idea was, okay, we'll sell Day's End and I'll take my $36 million or whatever. This is the guy who had married into the Day family. Richard Kessler was his name. And he was for a while sort of a big deal in Atlanta. And so Jack went to work for him because Richard decided that he wanted to start banks and he wanted to franchise banks just like they did Day's End. And Richard liked this idea because the idea is you can sell somebody the franchise, hand them the rule book and say, this is how you do things. And if you ever decide that you don't want to go along with everything I tell you to do, I'm coming and tearing your sign down because I own the sign. And so this is the kind of guy Richard was. He was sort of. And so Jack went to work for him with the idea we're going to try to work this deal out. We're going to do bank. We're going to do enterprise banks. And we started, Jack and I ended up starting like 12 different banks throughout the Southeast. And they're all enterprise banks. And the outfit that sold Richard on this guy, I'm going to string this thing out forever, but it was an outfit called BEI, Bank Earnings International. And they were a big swinging outfit in Atlanta. People like Jerry Eichhoff and people like that who made a fortune in bank consulting, starting banks. And then what they saw with Richard was money. We can separate Richard from his money. Well, they started down this road, and we had only 12 banks, I guess. And where the trouble started going wrong was that Richard didn't quite grasp the idea that the only people who can pull that sign down is not you; it's the controller of the currency. You don't have that authority. It's not like Day's End; you don't own anything other than the sign. And you can take the sign down, but you can't make them do anything,
right?
You know, so and that ended up being a fight between Jack and Richard, you know, because Jack really understood banking, and Richard really understood the motel business, so it didn't work. And so Jack at that point decided to go into bank consulting because he knew the stuff pretty well, and he involved me in a number of those things, like the Society Bank merger and things like that. So we got to know each other and started working together. And we were both working, and he had me working on the project in Cleveland, Ohio.
Yeah. Okay.
And where Society was. And he says, when we're going to get done with this. And he says, I'm working on a project at Turner Broadcasting. Would you like to be on that team? And that's the way it began. I said, sure, I'll do. Sounds good to me. I was single at the time, didn't have any obligations. I could be anywhere Jack needed me to be. And I really enjoyed working for Jack. He was a good man, a great man. And that's how it kind of twisted back in. And Jack said, look, I got the ugly job in here is I need to have somebody over wrestling because it's trouble inside. I said, how trouble? What do you mean trouble? And he says, because all of management wants to get rid of it. And the only reason they still own it is that Ted likes it.
Mm.
And so he's going to keep it. And the whole time I was there in the controllership role over sports and wrestling, nobody cared about wrestling. Nobody wanted it. Everybody wanted to get rid of it. They all liked the other stuff that I had. And that was like Braves, Hawks, the arena. And all those were fun, but not near as much fun as wrestling was. But Jack told me, he says, don't get close to these people because if you try to help them, they're going to get rid of it. They're getting rid of wrestling. And you don't want to be close to them or appear to be trying to help them.
Wow.
Because if you are and they find out or think that you're actually trying to do something right for wrestling, they're going to get rid of you. And I said, man, this is not my deal. But they had so many other things on fire, they didn't get around to it. And we had more things like accounting that we had to get a hold of it. Because it was a true mess. I don't know if some of the other guys have told you about the intercompany charges at Turner.
Yeah, so Eric Bischoff has made a lot of reference to intercompany allocations. And I want to ask you about that. But I think, I've read the Guy Evans book, the Nitro book, which I think you and I both highly recommend.
Yes,
and you
yes.
wrote something like, these are your words, I believe. When I got there, there were a lot of accounting problems, serious accounting problems. A lot of that had to do with the fact that Ted Turner didn't care much for accountants. The way he saw accountants was that they were necessary and that they built financial statements you could use to borrow money with, but they weren't risk takers. Now, that's true. As a group, accountants are not risk takers. We're just record keepers or scribes. But at TBS, there weren't very many real accountants, although there were a lot of bookkeepers. And, of course, part of that maybe some of our listeners might not really follow is, listen, leverage is a real thing in business. And so you show how much money you have on the books and how much money's coming and what your receivables are and what your cash flow is. And then you can go down to your local banker and get a line of credit for this thing or that thing and reinvest in your business and all that. Well, you write that you really spent your first 9 months with Turner just cleaning up those issues. For example, quote, we had something like $15 million in accounts receivable at Turner International. And when asked, what was the last time we got a payment on any of these receivables? The response was, well, I don't know. We haven't heard from any of those people in about 3 years. Okay, wait a minute. We haven't heard anything from these people that owe us $15 million. It sounds like you walked into a mess here from the jump. Did you not?
That's absolutely was. And we really didn't know how really, really bad it was early on, but it was all like that. And you know, the rules in accounting is if you carry a receivable on your books, it's an asset. Somebody owes you money. That's like an asset.
Yes.
But in order to keep it as an asset, it's got to perform well. You got to receive payments on it. You know, people got to be current. You got to be able to know where are they. We don't know where that guy is. His last address we had for him was in Greece. So when we start looking at this, the books are a mess because we are carrying impaired assets on our books that cannot be worth what the carrying value is. So that was the beginning of where real trouble started for Jack and me, because we said, look, here's the rules. If you don't know who the borrower is or who has the money, who has the contract, you can't find them, you don't know how to get in touch with, you don't have a current address, you don't know anything, then we can't carry it face value. We've got to start marking that stuff down. And then the pure accounting rules are charge it off.
Yes.
and that's where we were. And poor Jack, he had to go back and see Terry McGurk, who was at that point his boss, and say, look, here are the issue. You don't mean me coming here. We get the guy at Price Waterhouse who audits our books, and we can get him to come in and tell you that this $15 million is worthless. But you can take our word for it, or you can take their word for it. But this asset's going away. And it was through that all through there. And McGurk, Terry McGurk, took personal offense at that, saying, chewed Jack out about, I don't like you telling me bad things about my company. Mm. And Jack, I don't know how to respond to that. I don't have any room here. I'm not trying to make stuff up, but you have worthless assets on your books.
Yes.
And I think we had like 16 or 17 different projects that focused back on our books. They were not any good. They were not good. So we began a process of how do we get this whole thing straightened out. One of the things that contributed to this was this bundle load of intercompany transactions.
Okay.
I mean, this is a hard thing to get your hands around, but it has to do with a separate discipline within accounting, which is elimination or consolidation accounting. Because in Turner's case, we had 75 or 76 separate companies.
Oh.
That were, you know, inside Turner. So you had to find a way to consolidate this, because the reporting entity, the SEC, was Turner Broadcasting. And so it has to all collapse down into one company. But then you get into this whole issue of self-dealing is not the right deal, but we were dealing with ourselves. The cleanest example that I can come up with is that there are companies within Turner that sell things to other companies inside Turner.
I see.
And for example, one of the things is, you know, I don't know if you've ever been over CNN Center. I don't know if it's there anymore, but there was a Braves store.
Yes.
Inside, and there was a Turner store in there. And all these are separate entities of Turner Broadcasting, and they have a store inside the CNN Center. And the way you account for those sales is tricky, because throughout the whole Turner culture was that we are an entrepreneurial company. So we encourage entrepreneurial thought here. Now, this is where it starts to get funny. And they all of them have heard of themselves as entrepreneurial. I said, wait a minute. Near as I can tell, we only have one of those guys here.
Right.
He's the guy that owns this place.
Yes.
He's the guy that gets the book earnings when he makes a sale. The rest of you people just work here.
Yeah.
You're not entrepreneur. But you have to be careful about saying things like that, or else HR will come see you.
Sure.
But the idea, for example, is, let's say that you're working at your Turner's Braves store.
Okay.
Now the Braves stock the merchandise in the store, and you know how many people want to buy this stuff? Some people do, but not a whole lot of people. But where most of the stuff ended up going was the guys in international television would want to come through, and they got a whole load of Japanese business people are coming through to get the tour, and why they need to buy the Turner signal in Japan and everything. And when they would come through, the signal guys would say, I need to have a Braves package for all these Japanese businessmen.
Right.
And and really jack the prices up. We're going to charge. We'll put a jersey in each bag for Tom Glavine or something like that, you know, or whatever popular players we have, yeah. And get them a bag load of stuff that has a retail value of $2,000.
Oh wow!
When we threw money around, nobody keeps score. What they keep track of is sales,
yes,
not earnings. So what happens is, I almost have to diagram it out, but what you see on the books of Turner Broadcasting Store inside the CNN Center, where all the Braves merchandise is, they book what amounts to a sale for $2,000 per
businessman
per guy, and that's it's an intercompany entry at that point. Now the store is going to recognize $2,000 in sales for that transaction. Then on the Signal store, the Signal books, Turner International TV or whatever, they're going to record selling expenses of $2,000. So you get, that's an offset. $2,000 worth of income to the Turner store, $2,000 worth of expenses to TBS International. But that's not real.
Right.
Because the only real entries that show up are the expenses for the stuff that's in the bag. It may be $1,500, maybe $1,000. But that's the only real expense.
Right.
There is no income.
Right.
This is all a giveaway deal. But the people at Turner's store down there saying, our sales this year
yes.
are up this much. Look how good a job we're doing at the Turner store.
Yeah.
No, all you did was fill an order of
giveaways.
What amount of giveaways.
Yeah.
Now, when you put the books together, you know, the just for this example, there are eliminations that have to take place on the consolidation because the sale of $2,000 and the expense on the entities books over here, Turner International, those get eliminated when you put the books together. We scratch through that, scratch through that. The only real expense left here is the $1,500 worth of expenses that actually left the building and went to the supply of all this giveaway stuff. But that is all over the place. That crap is all over Turner. And it's things like a friend of mine, he's one of these guys that you like, but you know, you have to be careful about trusting him or not trusting him. The guy's name was Craig Apatow, great guy, but you know, he's operating out of his own sphere here. And he figures, hey, we need a color copy around here, but I can't afford one. Because they're expensive. In those days, color copy, Xerox copy was like a dollar.
Right.
So what Craig decided he would do was he was going to go ahead and buy one of these machines and then offer color copies to the rest of Turner Broadcasting. So he's in effect starting through consolidated accounting. He's going to offer his own copy center. And when people needed color copies, he would invoice for, you know, $1.50 a piece. So he now had a profit center called a color copier. And all of a sudden he's making money.
Right.
And all these other places were saying, well, shit, I have to do color copies for these presentations. So I'm going to go ahead and invoice all these people inside, pay my Xerox bill, and then we'll move on from there. And again, Apatow Center just explodes in terms of revenue.
Right.
Right. But it's not real because we have to eliminate that income off of his books and we eliminate the expenses off the entity that needed the color copiers made. So the only thing that really is left of that transaction when you collapse it is the Xerox bill for what the copies actually cost to turn to broadcasting.
Right.
And that's, I'm probably oversimplifying, but that is the essence of intercompany charges.
I wanted to mention something else that was written in the Nitro book. You said sales were everything. Their deal was a dollar of sales revenue is worth more than a dollar of cutting expense. To me, the impact on the bottom line is the same, but their deal was no, I need a dollar more in revenue, even if it takes me $2 more in expense to create it. It was all revenue driven. The whole company was revenue driven. That was the kind of mess we walked into, because from the perspective of some people who worked at Turner, collecting was just not as important as selling. It's like, if I can sell it, then I've earned my bonus, my commission, I'm a hero. Somebody else can collect the mess. And interestingly, although the public may not have realized it, there existed a logical reason for such an attitude. Underneath everything, Turner Broadcasting never really made a whole lot of money. It was all revenue, and it's hard to report to shareholders that you're not really making any money. This is just fascinating to me, because there's been so much from the wrestling side of things discussed about how WCW was ran and what the losses were and when they were profitable and things like that. And the story, even from the very beginning of WCW, back when, you know, Crockett sold to Turner, is that they ran at a loss every year through everyone, including Bill Watts, who I guess was the first guy to say, we've got to get these expenses under control. But finally, in 1995, and this is all from the Nitro book that Guy Evans put out, the year-end income statement clearly showed a profit of $283,466. That's from a total revenue of $43,937,499, and the total expense was $43,654,033. But that doesn't include interest, tax, depreciation, amortization. So it actually shows a net loss, a net income of minus 9.8 million. So even though we have celebrated forever, hey, we finally made a profit, and that was a great improvement, 95 still ended at a loss when you use GAAP, the generally accepted accounting principles, right?
If you consolidated accounting, it is a loss.
Yes.
In fact, Conrad, I don't think Turner Broadcasting ever made any money.
Wow.
I don't think TBS ever made any money. The whole thing was debt. Everything was debt. And so a lot, this is a hard thing. I could never get here because there are three of us at down there. Jack was one. I was one. The guy named Gary Plummer, who was over real estate accounting. And we look at this thing and says, I know we're talking EBITDA, you know, the interest.
Yes.
And that's just sort of a bullshit name for cash.
Yes.
Because that's just like what transactions go through here. We could never cut an earnings release that said what was really going on. Because if we did, none of the people who make a market in our stock could make a market. You know, I mean, so we dropped to EBITDA because that was the closest thing we'd go to say this is like earnings, but it's unique to our industry. And one of the things about broadcast or any other industry, I guess you could find, that has huge amounts of fixed costs.
Right.
You know, inside of Turner, most all of our expenses were fixed. We didn't have any variable expenses. Everything else, when I say fixed versus variable, how it behaves over a range of volume. Like there's no sales volume that has an expense associated with it. Maybe a few little things, but not many. So in our case, we had to come up with some bullshit. And we were really where the EBITDA started. You know, it fit real well within our mess. But these three old accountants, me and Jack and Gary Plummer, would look at this thing and say, guys, at some point, you can't stay in business long doing this. You have to make net income. Otherwise, you can't stay in business. You can't say EBITDA. No. that doesn't mean anything to most people. Most people understand net income versus net.
Yes.
Know? That's what matters. But yeah, that was a big issue for us. And ultimately, that's the trigger that made us sell, was we couldn't keep propping that debt up forever. And I'd done everything I could to hide that crap too. We were, I think, engaged in publishing misleading books. And then this is one of the reasons I started getting pissed off with accounting in general, because we are not doing what a real accountant should be doing, which is to report accurately the financial condition of the business as of this date. And we weren't doing that. We were finding a way of throwing the curtains up over what was really going on. I swear, I think that's an accounting issue that is much broader than Turner Broadcasting. You have misleading books,
right.
And here's the thing: I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but I'll tell you this: when I have trouble reading financial statements, that means that most people can't read financial statements. And if you just pick up an annual report and try to thumb through the notes of the financial statements, and they are not going to make sense to most people. And that is intentionally misleading the people who are going to be using the statements. It's like, you know, when you go to the eye doctor, and the eye doctor starts talking about, well, you got a and you know, you don't know what the hell he's talking about. And the doctors do it, accountants do it. They have their own language, because as long as they control the language, then they control the discussion. And we as an industry were doing that. And I kept asking Jack when this stuff was going on. So, Jack, I don't understand this. We're supposed to be an honest profession. We're supposed to. Why are we doing this? This is not right. This is misleading. And Jack, this is another needle point. Jack said, well, accountants like to drive BMWs too.
Wow.
And he's right about that. He didn't like it, but he's saying that's what's driving this deal.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing. And I figured, well, it's after being a CPA for 35 years, I really don't want to have my name associated with it anymore. I keep QuickBooks, and they're going to be more pure than anything anybody else is doing with an SEC registrant. That's terrible to say that, but that's
the way it works.
That's the way it works. That's the way it works.
So let's talk about when you first come over. I think I have it in my notes here that one of the first things you're tasked with helping on the Turner side of things are the properties that essentially nobody else wants to fool with, which is wrestling and the Omni. Is that right?
Yeah. And there was not a whole lot of sex associated with the Omni, but I liked it because that's the way I saw the Omni. It's just a box you put entertainment in.
Yes.
And again, I was single in those days, and what I would enjoy after work, because you know CNN Center was right next to the Omni, the old Omni. You know, I'm gone now, but I figured, what the fuck? I'd grab myself a six pack, and I'll go next door and sit on the Omni floor and watch them make ice. You know, I just sit by myself and drink beer and watch them run the
Zamboni and all that.
Yeah. And it was fun to watch. I enjoyed doing it. You know, occasionally I sit there and I'd see a puck and screaming down the ice because the Atlanta Knights would be down there drilling at one end and while the Zambonis made the ice on this end. And that to me is enjoyable and relaxing. And I got to really, the Omni is just a restaurant that has, entertainment. That's really what it was. In fact, I had to run the, We had two dining rooms inside the Omni. It was the Omni Club, I guess is what it was called. And that was a funny damn thing there because we couldn't make any money at the in any of the eateries inside the dining rooms. It was really pretty good food. And it turned out, I started going over there working at night. So when you're single and you don't have anything to do, you can go do things like this, you know. And right. I'm interested in what goes on here, whatever, figure it out. So I'd go over there and, you know, run the cash register streets. And, you know, I'd go over and try to figure out why are we losing money here. And what we were doing was that they had come up with this idea over there at the Omni. And nobody was really paying attention to business, actually. And what they were doing was the idea is that we're not going to have any waste because if we've cooked food that that can't be consumed that night, we can't hold it over. We're going to take it all to the homeless shelter because that's the kind of people we are. We care. Well, we didn't care anything about earnings. I'll tell you that because we would load out thousands of dollars worth of steaks.
Oh.
And take it down to the homeless because that's our mission. We're going to do the right thing. We're not going to waste anything. so that's where it went. I find out about stuff like this just by sniffing around and lifting up some pans and things in the kitchen to figure out what's going on. But again, nobody cared about that. They cared about sales. and for that matter, food going out the door to a charity is the same as sales because you got nothing left. You know?
Yeah, you got to go buy new steaks now. Yeah.
So
let's talk about Bischoff. I think when you first come into WCW, Bob Dew was running things, and I think Ole is handling the wrestling side of things. And one of the first things that Bischoff does is he eliminates the house shows. He sees that, you know, there's really not going to be a way to profitability on the house show side. And you actually have in the Nitro book, this quote, "I thought he being Bischoff, was a real plus for us. He took us from an arena based thought process to a television based thought process. And there's this thing in accounting called cost volume profit analysis. It's the study of behavior of cost and revenue over a relevant range of volume. And that's what I told him in 93, quote, God knows we got to get out of the arenas because there's a capacity limit, end quote. And I think Eric understood that.
Yes.
You were an advocate for Eric early on as well. And I know we talked off air about the way you felt about Eric and he was in a no-win position. We'll table that for a moment, but you also wrote in the book that you didn't think Eric was really a corporate type. How was Eric different in his approach to wrestling from, say, the combination maybe of Bob Dew and Ole Anderson?
Well, in the case of Bob and Ole, by the way, I like those guys.
Yes.
You know, their whole life had been the arena. See, Bob was raised in a the girl he married, nice girl. Her father had been the guy running the first Atlanta arena. So Bob kind of got into a business because it was like a family business, you know? And all he could focus on was the arena. He got the arena. He got the restaurant business. He got the arena entertainment. He got it. He got all that. And Ole, if you ask Ole, the first thing that came out of Ole's mouth was, I can put 14,000 butts in the seats in the Omni.
Yep.
His whole focus was that. And Eric had an appreciation for that. But he saw the capacity constraints, but he also understood I'd drawn a bunch of charts out where we were able to chart capacity. And you didn't really free the business until you could say the number of seats we have is not a constraint anymore.
Right.
And our business needs to focus on out beyond the existing seats, and television's the only thing that's going to get it. And Eric really got that. He got that some because you'd come out of Burns' organization. And they had television. Well, they had, it was a traditional business. He was vertically integrated because he developed his own wrestlers. He had his own television portion of it. So he got that. So he had a much broader understanding at the very beginning than Ole or Bob had. And that's just the way they were raised, you know?
Yeah, it's all they had known, it's all they were doing and all they had done. And just to be clear, said differently, the capacity word we're talking about is, folks, there's only so much you can charge for tickets, and there's only a finite amount of tickets in the arena. So your income opportunity is capped. There is a ceiling there. However, yeah, if you get more people to watch your television product, well, now you can charge more for the advertising because the more folks watching, the more the ads cost. So you can scale a lot faster. So it was smart to do that. And of course, Eric gets a lot of credit for making the move to Disney, but you actually had this to say. If you look at who was running these companies, they were either entertainment people or journalism people, but they weren't really business people. For example, yeah, Eric went and signed a 10 or 20 year deal with Disney. And I said, we've got to unwind this son of a bitch. It sounds like a good idea. And even people he checked with at corporate said the same. But the problem was, that is a recordable event. It's called a capital lease. If you sign a 20 year lease, that's got to be on your balance sheet. I said, let's find a way to modify it. We'll make a verbal commitment and we'll just sign 1 or 2 year leases. That way I kept it off the balance sheet. Can you explain that for us a little more?
Yeah. Well, yes. Yeah. There are what I call current assets and long-term or fixed assets. And generally those things reference the length of the accounting cycle. And in most circumstances, an accounting cycle, like a year, should have every accounting transaction that is short term included in that 1 year. If you have a transaction that affects longer periods, like if you buy a building, for example, that building may have a depreciable life cycle of 30 years. Well, that, because you can't consume the asset within an accounting cycle, then some of the recognition of what remains on that asset after the current accounting period is recordable as a fixed asset, long-term asset, because it's life left in it. About the simplest. Now, there are a lot of fixed assets that are not tangible. You know, you think of a fixed asset as being a building and something you can actually touch. But there are plenty of fixed long-term assets that are not tangible, you know, like a copyright. You know, you can't, it's not something you pick up, live, juggle, you know, it's not physical. You know, you pick it up. But that's still recordable as a longer term asset and consumable over a much longer period of time. Like a building, you depreciate a building. And that's, ends up being an accounting term because that's the way you recognize the expenses associated with that asset, even though the cash went out of here 2 years ago, you know. And that's what Pricewaterhouse loved to celebrate, that about EBITDA being okay, because the thing about EBITDA is that we're not really going to worry about non-current assets. That's the cash is already, that's already gone. We paid for that stuff 3 years ago. So we're not going to spend it again. It's already out the door.
Right.
But from an accounting perspective, we have to spread it over the period of time where the actual cost is incurred, rent, you know, or, you know, and I used to tell my students, we start talking about this kind of stuff. I know this is bad. I used to teach accounting, and what I'd do before we started the conversation, so this stuff's hard to listen to. I'm just imagine your ears are starting to bleed, but I'd pass out gaffer tape in the classroom so everybody had a roll. I said, we'll get into this thing, and once we're into it for about 10 minutes, you'll be thinking, my head's going to explode. And I said, okay, start wrapping the gaffer tape around your head because it won't stick to your hair. And when your head does explode, we'll be able to have all the pieces left. But this is hard to deal with. So I understand.
Let's talk about the success that WCW enjoyed starting in 96. It's written in the book, yeah. In any event, Bischoff understood that internally WCW had finally been recognized for exceeding its foregoing projections. In 96, therefore, he looked to receive both an increase in terms of resources and expectations, an apparent double-edged sword, if not for Ted's ultimate position as financial arbiter. For as many company veterans would recall, a personal guarantee offered by the chairman during the lean years provided all the assurances necessary, regardless of whether WCW made money or not. And I guess this is what I wanted to talk about is, now that it feels like it's finally out of the red and it's making money, the narrative has been out there for a long time that there's still a ton of Turner executives who just do not want wrestling. And you, yeah. I believe, would be one of the guys arguing that the eyeballs, that's a real metric that matters in broadcasting, prove that wrestling should be a bigger priority maybe than they think. For instance, a Braves game wouldn't get near the viewership as a Monday Nitro, but everybody within the organization, yay Braves, boo wrestling. Is that pretty much it?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. But it was not just baseball. It was that, you know, I heard McGurk say this a number of times. We are the news and entertainment company of the next century. And we don't see wrestling as part of that because it's lowbrow. And I can remember being thrown out of places where I said, well, I know you don't like it. You think it's lowbrow. But if it is, look at the ratings. And if you think these people that watch on TV are stupid, look at the hits on the internet.
Yeah.
We'll get wrestling. We'll get more hits in the morning than CNN is going to get in a month.
Wow!
And if this is so about the entertainment news company of the next century, there must be a shitload of Pentium chips out there in those trailer parks, because somebody's wearing the internet out to find out about wrestling and not news and not entertainment.
Right.
So of course, that's when, didn't make many friends in Terry McGurk's conference room with remarks like that, but it's the truth. I mean, that's the truth. There are a lot of people. In fact, I remember, this would have been back in, 94. Sometimes I stopped by Eric's office just to shoot the shit, and I was telling him some stuff I had read on the internet, and he didn't know what I was talking about. And I said, "Well, we're not really at that point. We're internet in terms of wrestling was things like What was that? You got mail stuff.
AOL.
AOL, yeah. AOL had all kinds of chat rooms. And I said, Eric, here, sometimes if I'm sitting around and I got 5 minutes, I'll check this. I'd pull it up. What everybody was talking about. And what I kept saying is, I know there's no revenue in this at this point, but there's information about what people are talking about. And And it's just stuff you ought to know, is background, what people believe. And it's free market research. But I think he got interested in that. I showed him how to log on a couple of places. But early on, what Eric, I think, saw that as electronic dirt sheets, I guess.
Yes, yes.
And probably it was, you know, probably it was. But it's still, anytime somebody is going to tell you what they think about your product, it's a good idea
to listen.
To listen. Yeah.
Well said. Something else in the book that has often been parroted a lot is about how Ted stood up for wrestling. Quote,
oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, this is something we did every stinking year. There was a crop of MBAs that got hired to help strategic planning. You know, that was every year. And they'd all start these planning meetings. And this is a typical example of the kind of bullshit that I'm talking about. The crop of MBAs who says, well, we got our first major idea for the planning cycle for this year. We want to sell the Braves. And I said, oh, this is pretty interesting. And why is that? Well, because they always lose money. And I would say, well, okay, let's go back and talk about why is that? Why do the Braves lose money? I don't know. It's not a good product. No. It's a good product. The reason the Braves lose money is it loses money on purpose, because there's a rule in baseball, and you guys check on this, you know, that if you make money, and if you own a baseball team and it makes money, there is a Major League Baseball surcharge on your income of 8%.
I see.
And so, you know, it may not be good accounting in terms of, this is one of the real problems at Turner, was that we weren't using accounting to tell us how the business was doing. We were using accounting to manage the amount of money we get to keep. And if we would sell the rights to broadcast Braves games to TBS and charge them 2 bits, then a big piece of their revenue that would be on every other baseball team's books is not there anymore, because we recognize that income at TBS. You know, the broadcast rights cycle through TBS, the broadcast company, not Braves baseball. And that saved us 8% of net income. And so these guys, again, I'm not saying that they would have known this, because it's not good accounting, but it is good earnings management. Does that make sense?
Yes.
That's why the Braves never made any money. It's because we didn't want them to make any money, because it just meant we'd have to pay 8% for the same product. You know, the same effect. Recognize any revenue associated with the Braves at the at Turner Broadcasting, so you don't pay surcharges on it.
Right.
And that stuff was spread throughout our accounting system. And that's why I say, Conrad, I don't think maybe there were 5 people who understood this, because it's not like the way accountants actually track earnings.
Yeah.
This is the way you manage earnings. How about that's a better way of saying it? This is the way you manage it, so that you don't pay any more taxes.
Let me quote you on something that I didn't know until I read the Nitro book, and I've never talked to Mr. Crockett about it. And I happen to be pretty good friends with David Crockett these days, and I think he's a great guy. But it's written in the Nitro book. It was never, and this is your quote, it was never the intent of Turner management that WCW make money, because the Crockett family still owned a participating interest in WCW. Yeah. If WCW yeah. started making real money, the Crocketts would have had a substantial interest in those earnings. Of course, you yeah. can still make money that you don't have to share by recognizing ad revenue at TBS, not WCW. But the scheme begins to deteriorate when you crank up pay-per-views to 12 a year, with buy rates rising and no way to recognize the cash flow at another Turner entity. Greed is yes. an ugly thing, especially when your success depends on screwing a business partner or associate. If you can acquire control of a property without buying the whole thing, and then assure that it never makes income you have to share with a partner, you win.
Man, I said that. God almighty. That's goddamn brilliant.
I had never heard this, that the Crockett family was supposed to participate, and there was some creative accounting going on the Turner side to make sure that they didn't pay the Crocketts. That to me is fascinating, that this is the same company that does that, but also seemingly throws a boatload of cash at ideas like the No Limit Soldiers and Kiss and Hogwild. And we've got all these different ideas that we're just throwing cash at, including maybe some inflated wrestler contracts. But the folks who started the doggone thing, well, let's make sure we share as little with them as possible. Is that real? This is breaking news to me. I had no idea.
Ask David.
Okay.
Because I've never asked him for particulars about this, but I know that Terry McGuirk, when he found out that WCW was making money and that they still owned a piece of, I forgot what the percentage was. It was less than 10%, I think. I think it was less than 10%. It wasn't a controlling interest. But Terry, when McGuirk found out about it, he threw a fit about it. And his timing was always terrible. He said, get a hold of them, buy them out. I want them all bought out at this point. I don't want to deal with this question again. And I don't know how big the number was. I never was nosy enough to ask David how much money Rocket Family got when Turner finally settled up. But they did. And it was right after WCW stopped making money. So you couldn't have a better deal, right? You couldn't have a better deal. Wait a minute. They own a piece of this? Oh, no. Then buy them out. I don't want this. We're going to make a ton of money in wrestling. I don't want it to go to anybody else but us. And I think we never made any more money. After that, the old agreement stood in place. I don't think there's ever a way that they could have had it happen at the best time, because at that point, the stock, the WCW Crockett family stock would have been at its highest value ever, never returned there again. So it's like they sold on top. We've been getting money all along. We got money all along, but now we got a pop here that could never really happen if somebody knew what they were doing. One thing Eric always told me was wrestling is a cycling business. It's about a 30-year cycle. And that's how long it takes to go through a whole new crop of customers. And then they get tired of it. And then they, I remember specifically when he told me that, and we were driving down to Cherokee Roads. Sporting Clays. We were going down to shoot Sporting Clays down there, and we were just talking about the business. We're talking about the Crockett stuff, but we're talking about the longer term cycle of wrestling. It's like roller derby, I guess, to a certain extent. I mean, there'll come a time where everybody thinks roller derby is great again.
Right.
And people will, and then it just goes away. we're kind of thinking of, I think we're probably in a flat spot in wrestling right now, because the product is not as good as it was 20 years ago, I don't think, except at the indies.
We talked about that off air. I do want to talk about how you keep up with wrestling these days. But before we do, I wanted to ask a little more about just understanding the way the dollars are moving around. Because as I understand it, a lot of people have said that Ted was a big wrestling fan and he wanted to keep it on. And when these NBAs would come in and say it's lowbrow and we need to get rid of this or that, allegedly, I think you were quoted as saying Ted's attitude was, quote, where else can I get original programming for $300,000 a week? And on top of that, I like it, so it stays. The idea that we've got these expenditures of going live every week, sometimes twice a week, and we're carving off a lot of that ad revenue to TBS, not WCW. So even though it's the WCW program that got the viewer, this is long before television rights fees, and it wouldn't have even been a thing because Turner owned it anyway. But now when the ad revenue comes in, we just credit more of that to the TBS ledger, less of that to the WCW ledger. As I understand it, a lot of the pay-per-views are certainly the cassettes, like the VHS versions of the pay-per-views that went under the Turner Home Entertainment silo, not necessarily the WCW one. So there's been a debate for a long time, and a lot of the industry trades, guys like Wade Keller and Dave Meltzer, and I think you were called them dirt sheets earlier, they go back and forth on how much money WCW lost. But a lot of people hang their hat on, they lost $60 to $80 million in that last year. And Bischoff says, that's not true. And in fact, nobody knows the real number. You were there. Do you think how much do you think, if anything, WCW lost in the year 2000?
I don't know. See, I don't know, because I was not there at the time.
I see.
I don't know. I think they had peaked and were probably 18 months into the downslide at that point.
Yes.
Because that was when we had people like Screaming Norman Smiley and everything headlining. I don't know, but we were way past the peak. And at that point we were headed south. And I remember, because while this was going on, I went over to, Vince was doing a show, at the Omni, I think it was here in Atlanta. It was
okay.
And I went over, and one of the things I told Evan the other day was, and I ended up knowing a lot about what was going on, because I dressed like I belonged there, and I went over to the locker room where the WWE event was. And well, when I, you know, for 50 years, I wore a three button suit and a white shirt and a 3 1/4 inch tie. And there was a book years ago that everybody read called Dress for Success by John Loy. And there's no better book than anybody should read. It tells you this is the way you would present yourself. And I always dress that way just for business. I walk over to the, in those days, or whenever I went to a WWE event, I would just go and show up. And I would walk anywhere I wanted, and nobody would stop me, you know, because I guess people figured he might be somebody. I better not fuck with him.
Yeah.
And I walk inside the, and I ran into Steve Austin when I was over there, and I said, "Hey, how you doing?" Because I used to know him, you know, when he was us.
Right.
The common thing that we shared was turkey hunting and turkey calling. And I'd give him some turkey calls, but I always say hello to him. And whenever I was in their locker room, I asked him, and this is in the day of Norman Smiley.
Okay.
Which I think it was weird. Oh God! That was, and I said, I have to ask you, Steve. What do you think? I know you stay in touch with what we do, and you look at our programming. And what do you think of what's going on now, and your former employer? And what he said to me was, it sounds to me like Eric Bischoff has run out of ideas, and it kind of stuck with me. And I really think at that particular point, I'm not sure Eric had run out of his ideas, but I think he was under a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
And he had a lot of things put on him that he didn't have any help with. So, yeah.
Let's talk about how some of that maybe started. A lot of people say that Eric got for lack of a better word, lost in the sauce because he became a television character. And guys like Jim Cornette and others have been critical, saying that he was more interested in being one of the guys and one of the boys or a television character. Even his buddy Hogan has made that accusation before. And as I understand it, it's even in the Nitro book. You guys had a conversation about this. Your partner is saying, I was sitting in my office one day and I got a phone call from Eric and he said, I'm thinking about joining the program. And I said, okay, what do you mean? He said, I'm going to be a part of the storyline. I'm not going to be an announcer anymore. I'm going to be part of the NWO. What do you think? What I told him was, I think it's a bad idea, Eric. Right now you're in a company that nobody likes, but what you've done is virtually impossible. You've turned it around, and inside of Turner Broadcasting, there's only two people that have had that kind of success. One is John
Berholtz and Eric Bischoff.
He took the Braves from worst to first, the World Series in a year, and you've taken WCW, that was nothing, and you beat the industry leader, Vince McMahon. I said, right now, you don't have a lot of people inside of TBS that are great executives, and you have a hell of a story. Not as a part of a wrestling story, but as a turnaround executive inside of Turner Broadcasting. That was the pitch I made because, right or wrong, I thought that was the best possible way for Eric to do career planning. With the benefit of hindsight, I know how you felt then. With the benefit of hindsight, do you think Eric Bischoff in the story of WCW would have been any different had he not become a television character? Or do you think it all wound up in the same place?
I still think I was right.
Yeah.
I don't argue with him, but look back at the time when this was going on, our entertainment top dog was a guy named Scott Sasser.
Yes.
And he was leaving. I think he was going, where was he going? Sony or someplace. And I said, Jesus, this couldn't have come at a better time. The opening is just there for Eric to step into the deal where he'll run all of entertainment because he's got this success. And I don't think Eric liked that idea. You know, he didn't ask my advice after that anymore on anything. So, but I still think it's the right decision. But I think he loved wrestling. I think he wanted to stay with it just because he loved it.
I wanted to ask too, you know, you said that one of the things you were critical of with Eric, you said, now there were some things about Eric in some ways were serious flaws. Eric wanted to keep everything a secret. Everything had to be really, really secret. What that meant was you didn't have a script except in your head. So you didn't really have a tight show. And you're saying this, you could even see this from a wrestling fan and an accountant standpoint. That was still the case.
Yes. And there was something. The first time I noticed this is that he was concerned about absolute control over information. He hated the dirt sheets. And I saw him. We used to do, this was back in 94, I guess. Somebody somewhere, I don't know who it was, owned an interest in a cowboy dance place and restaurant called the Crystal Chandelier up in Kennesaw. And we did 10 weeks worth of wrestling up there. They put the arena up down in the middle of the dance pit, and they would come out and wrestle there. And that's some great stuff up there. It wasn't advertised. You just had to know about it. But we did 10 weeks there. And I saw great stuff there. I saw the Hollywood Blondes wrestle up there, you know, back when it was Austin and Pillman. God, that was great.
But it didn't draw well. I mean, you guys had 42 tickets sold one show, 58 tickets sold another. Maybe not the best business decision WCW ever made.
Yeah, but it was... there was a purpose, though, and the idea was this will give us a chance to try out stuff in front of a live audience that is not going to be part of a. So I could see that. I could see it give people working and not a broad exposure. But God, I saw there Tom Zink and Terry Taylor.
Oh yeah,
I mean that was a great match.
Yeah.
so yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Bill Shaw. I know that Bill Shaw is the guy that Eric's going to be reporting to. This is before Harvey Schiller comes in.
Yes.
And in your interview with Guy Evans for the Nitro book, you said that Bill would call you and say, what'd you think about WCW Saturday night? And I would say, it sucked. It was a series of squash matches. At that point, Shaw would say, I saw exactly the same thing. He'd pick up the phone and call Eric and chew him out. Why are we putting stuff like that on TV? And it ended with Shaw and Eric having a really good working relationship. At that point, the corporate oversight really helped a lot. Later, Terry McGuirk decided that he wanted to hire someone who really understood sports. And I think underneath everything, he wanted to get someone who would eventually take over the Turner sports team. He hired Harvey Schiller. The tragedy is that Schiller had a lot of talent that went to waste. He didn't provide the kind of oversight that Bill Shaw provided, the kind that kept Eric Bischoff on track. Bischoff is not a corporate creature. He needed someone that was on the 14th floor to provide that kind of guidance and support. I think that was a real problem when Shaw was replaced by Harvey Schiller. Harvey didn't care about wrestling. He didn't care about it at all. He was there for something else altogether. So I don't think that gets talked about enough that, you know, people, when they talk about Russo, and we'll talk about Russo in a minute, when they talk about Russo's success, they say, well, he enjoyed that success in the WWF because he had a filter named Vince McMahon. And I think your words here sort of say Bischoff enjoyed his most success when he had a filter named Bill Shaw. But when the filter was changed to Harvey, well, things went downhill pretty quickly.
Yeah. Harvey didn't care about wrestling. He wanted to be, Steinbrenner. He thought he could be over a sports.
Harvey did.
Yeah. And that's right. And we started doing goofy shit then too. Well, who was he trying to buy? He wanted to buy a soccer team. And it was Arsenal. Does it sound like one?
Yeah, that's a huge team. Yeah.
Yeah, he wanted to buy that. Now, another example of the kind of people that are drawn into this, Harvey liked mogul money. He wanted big money, and he didn't give a shit about the details.
Right.
And he had worked out a deal where he was going to, and he made the pitch to Ted where they were going to buy Arsenal using TBS stock. There was a guy over there who was Harvey's number guy, Alan. It'll come to you as soon as we hang up. But he convinced Harvey, this is a terrible mistake because at this particular point, TBS stock wasn't liquid. And it had better value in another deal.
Right.
It was a terrible idea. But Harvey didn't have good sense about big deals. He understood big and he understood deal, but he didn't understand righteous deal. And that was not one for us to buy a soccer team in another half a world. But that was what Harvey wanted. He felt like that was making a big deal in the world that he would be the guy driving Arsenal. Now, that's also why we ended up with the Thrashers.
Yes.
He wanted to have another. We only had one sports guy, really, and that was Stan Kasten. He was the guy that was over the Braves and the Hawks. And that's really the job that Harvey wanted. He wanted Stan's job, and Stan wasn't leaving until he left here to go to the Nationals and then ultimately to the Dodgers. And he was a great guy. I enjoyed working for him. He was really a good guy to work for too, because I would tell people in wrestling this, I tell them every place else, you better know your numbers, because if you don't know your numbers, you're going to be no help to the guy that's driving. And in the case of Stan Kasten, he would ask me how much money we're going to make in the Braves this year, and that's a question you can't answer because you got to make assumptions. Well, if we have a Cy Young Award go to Glavine this year, and if he pitches under 3.5 ERA, you know, if you make all these assumptions, this is where all the bonuses kick in. This is where all the Braves money was. You know, players made the most money based on their incentives. And you couldn't just say, they're going to make this amount of money based on the amount of revenue they're coming. No. If you want to know net income, how much they make, it has to you have to click in all the bonuses, and you have to know the team and their stats well enough to tell the boss what the numbers are going to equal if the season ends tomorrow.
Yes.
You know, and that's the type of stuff that I liked about it. And most people don't want to get into that kind of deal.
Right.
Make the deal in your head 8 or 10 different times to see what the numbers are going to. Who was that? We had a guy, he was a shortstop, Glenn, and every fourth year he'd have a great year. And the great year he'd have would be salary time. And he'd normally bat 225 until he got to renegotiation time. And that he'd find a way to hit 275.
I love it.
But if you were going to give any help to the guy that was running it, you had to be able to know the numbers.
Right.
And guys like Harvey couldn't do those calculations or had no drive to do that. So
let's talk about those numbers, because there's something else in the Nitro book that stood out to me. We've talked a little bit about intercompany allocations, as Bischoff calls it, on 83 weeks. And one of these maybe happens with your help. Apparently, as the story goes, David Crockett and Neil Pruitt were looking for a new digital production truck. Quote, my deal was, okay, how much?
Oh, yeah.
They said $2 million. I said, don't worry, I got you covered. I'll find a way to hide it. So I spent $2 million of Turner's money to improve the programming when everybody else was fighting for nickels. But my deal was, I loved wrestling. I loved it. How could you hide $2 million? What a great story.
Oh, yeah, that's the hiding. It had to do with loan covenants.
Okay.
Because again, it's a truck, it's fixed asset, you know, a long-term asset. And because it's a long-term asset, you're limited to capital expenditures, one of the loan covenants, you know, a loan said, okay, during the coming year, you can spend no more than $100 million on capital expenditures. And the capital expenditures would be things that are long-term fixed assets or Disney leases, you know, things like that. You can't sign an agreement that allows you to put more than the whole company, $100 million in fixed assets this year. Okay, that's a restriction. We're bound by it. And if somebody catches us doing it, then they can say, all right, we're calling the loan. And that's something you can't do. You can't do it. And you can't have it. But this is how great sometimes fortune is. Shaw at that point had put me in charge of all capital expenditures at Turner Broadcasting. I had to meet with the person who wanted to spend the money, go through why is it necessary, why do we have to have it, can we live with that, you know, that kind of process. And since I had to approve every one, that put me in a good place to do it.
Right.
Even if it was, and that's what I did. I can talk enough accounting bullshit where people can't understand me. And you know, I had to defend it. You know, David said he had to have the truck, and I said, there used to be a thing when I was got my MBA. There were all kinds of capital expenditure formulas and things like that. And the one thing was always an escape clause, which was called the law of the situation, which means the essence of our business drives on this. It doesn't matter how much money we make or can't make. We have to do it, you know? And so I said, okay, law of the situation, that's it. So I just found a way to bullshit my way around it. And it really was a good decision, too, because that digital truck was so much better. Because I watched in those days, I watched every pay-per-view. And the one thing I noticed about that, it was War Games is what it was. And you know how they flip the coin and
yes.
Who goes in first?
Yes.
Well, I've watched every one of them, and you got to be in touch with your business, right? If you're going to make a difference, you have to. And what I noticed when they tossed that coin, I said, shit, that's a head. I can see it. That's wow. How good the camera is. And now it made sense, because if somebody was actually paying attention and they weren't watching this signal, then they could tell the announcers were bullshitting. That is not a head, that's a tail. You know, that's how good the cameras were.
Right.
But that's.
Well, something I've wanted to ask you about that was in the Nitro book, they had some good cameras floating around in Virginia in 1998, and certainly at the CNN Center. When DX comes in and invades, and there is a photo of you in the Nitro book doing the crotch chop alongside China and Hunter Hearst Helmsley. How in the world is a WCW dyed-in-the-wool guy like you out here crotch chopping with the enemy, man?
Well, look, that's a good accusation. I shouldn't have been doing it. But the thing is, I love the business. And,
right.
And I knew those. See, I knew Levesque. I knew him because he, when he was.
Terrorizing with y'all.
Yeah, terrorizing. Yeah, and he was. And I knew about him early on because some of the guys in production would say, you got to see this guy. He's the next Ric Flair.
Wow.
You know? So, okay, that means I got to go find him. And I met him. And I thought he was a nice guy. And then the other guys that were part of that group, and they're cut off in the book. You don't see him. You don't see Road Dogg.
Right.
And you don't see
Billy Gunn and Sean Waltman, the whole group.
Yeah, everybody was there except the two that got cut off. And I think that was, who were the two that were cut off?
I think it was Waltman and Road Dogg. They weren't in the photo.
Yeah, okay.
But so they show up and you hear they're there and you decide I'm going to go down and see what's going on.
Well, what happened was in those days we were in the South Tower and my assistant had the interior window so she could look down in CNN Center, and I always took I don't need to have a view. I'll just give me an office nobody wants. Anybody could want that, but I don't. And my assistant said, hey, you're not going to believe who's down there. I said, who? She says, China's down there. I said, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
And I went over to her window and looked outside. Hey, all of the eggs is down there. Get the camera. So we went down there. And, of course, the ex at that point was down there in a fight with security. And that's when I told you about wearing the suits.
Dress for success.
Somebody you trifle with. And I went down there and started explaining to security that these were important people. And I they're friends of mine. They used to work here. And anything they want to do around here, you guys go along with. And they didn't know what to do, who to call, but they let me get by with it. So I dragged it down into the food court and everything.
My goodness.
And of course, I sent a picture of, I didn't just do it blind. I sent a copy of a picture to Eric. So, you know, it's like I was doing something behind his back. And I like those guys, you know.
Right.
Like friends of mine.
Sure.
They don't work for us. You know, they're just my guest in CNN Center right now. But that probably was in bad form. I probably shouldn't have done it.
Well, it's starting to turn for Bischoff. And you said this in the Nitro book. Bischoff was starting to feel the walls close in. This is in 1999. It was becoming absolute torture. He later described it dealing with high-priced talent and corporate suits. He was under more pressure than anybody I've ever seen in corporate America. Most people would have what we call a rabbi, someone up top who's your sponsor, someone who looks after you. Well, Eric didn't have one. Eric didn't have a rabbi. HR was hunting for him. Corporate management didn't care for him. They were dialing in on him. Did he say something somewhere that somebody took the wrong way? Is he creating a hostile workplace? Additionally, from a creative standpoint, Bischoff seemed to have no more answers for the WWF, whose ratings were climbing astronomically. Listen, I love that quote, and I don't think enough people really give credit sometimes to Eric for what he did to take a company that was losing cash, that was so far in the rearview mirror, nobody could even see him. And then he beat Vince McMahon, not once, which nobody else has ever done once. He beat him 83 weeks in a row. And for you to come here as someone who worked in this organization and say he was under more pressure than anybody I've ever seen in corporate America is a hell of a statement. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. That's, I forget, you know, as you read that back, it's a shit. That's where do you hear that? It was in the book, you know. But yeah, that's dead solid perfect. That's exactly true. I've seen him sometimes, and it was not like he was in there anymore. He had his mind on too many things, and he had no support, and he didn't have it. His rabbi was Bill Shaw.
Right.
And at that point, Bill had no longer with the organization. Bill had gone to take care of Turner's ranches, his real estate properties. But Bill Shaw was a decent guy. He was a very decent guy. I knew him pretty well, even after I left Turner. I stayed in touch with him some. And he would show up at the, we would have wrestling reunions, and Bill would still come. Him and a guy named Paul Beckham, who had been the CFO down there earlier than before I got there. But nice people. Ended up all things. I ended up knowing Beckham pretty well because my wife was his assistant. Is why, same person. So, yeah. But
talk to me a little bit about Vince Russo. We haven't spent any time talking about him. I know you're still hanging around when Russo comes in. What was your experience like with Vince Russo, if any?
Well, I'll tell you, I didn't really get to know him, but I got a call one day when I'm sitting at my desk, and it's Bill Bush, and Bill had been an accountant, a nice guy. Like, Bill's a nice guy. He's a nice guy, but this is when his dreams came true, and he was the one exception that we had to the rule, which was, we are not going to have a controller in any of the Turner companies that is not a CPA, because he needed to have that bulletproof vest on, where if he's under attack by the operating head who said, I want these numbers to equal that, we had to have a controller had to be a certified public accountant. That was the rule we had. And Bush wasn't a CPA. And when Don Edwards decided he wanted to go over to the he had been the controller. He wanted to go into the operation side of wrestling. He became a production guy for David. He was a good guy. He's trying to help the way he could, but he was and Bill Bush wanted that job. And so what that meant was now operations is back in it, and they're going to make these decisions, not accounting anymore. So that was when the accounting side began to weaken. Jack was gone. They'd run him out. And I was, at that point, I think I was the only one left inside Turner that had the original vision about how we'll have an organization that's strong enough to defend itself against operational people who want to make sure they get the bonus by jamming the books.
Right.
Funny. So, but Bill was that. And he called me to say, look, I've just got the scoop of a lifetime. I've hired the brain trust from WWE. And this is Vince Russo. He's the guy that did all the stories. He's the guy. And I said, well, congratulations, Bill. I don't know this guy, but congratulations. I'm glad you got something that's going to help you, because we need help right now, you know. And I think Bill, as nice a guy as he was, he was not the right guy. He was not the right guy.
Well, a couple of the right guys you did bring in 1996 were Scott Hall and Kevin Nash. Of course, that wound up in a lawsuit. And then another lawsuit that made lots of headlines went down in 1998 between Ric Flair and Eric Bischoff. Were you familiar and involved in either one of those pretty famous lawsuits?
I knew about them, but I was not involved in it. Nobody else asked me for my opinion.
Right.
At that particular point, though, that would not have been a good place to be. I had told Eric a couple of times that he misused one of the greatest talents in the business, and that was Ric Flair.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, I love Eric, but there are times when he, like that time he got in that fight with up at Crystal Chandelier with a dirt sheet guy.
Right.
And I told Eric, you don't want to fight these guys. You know, it's like, who was it? What says the New York Times, don't get in an argument with a guy that buys ink by the barrel. And these guys are an influence, like them or not. And you find a way to use them, but you don't try a way to abuse them. And he would want to fight with them. Eric was showing signs of stress with everybody who was offering an opinion against his. And I think in 75% of the time, Eric was right about everything. But there were times when he wanted to take issue with the Nature Boy. And I think that's somebody you have to learn how to use and work with, despite his idiosyncrasies. What is that word?
Yeah.
Idiosyncratic nature. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are funny things about Rick. He's a funny guy, but don't fight with the, who was, it was Kip Fry.
Yes.
Probably resonated with me.
Yes.
I think Kip was the guy that fired Rick.
No, it was actually Jim Herd. Original
Jim. Okay, that's right. It was Jim Herd. That's right. I remember the story. I didn't see it, but the story was that Herd fired Rick while Ted was out of town or something.
Oh wow!
And when Ted came back into town, he went down to Herd's office and just walked around the office for about a minute and a half, didn't say anything, looked down at him and said, I just wanted to see the guy that had the nerve to fire Ric Flair.
Yeah.
You're fired. Now that's
a big statement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think he's a pizza guy, right? He was the guy.
That's right. Pizza Hut. Yeah.
Yeah. And he just was in the wrong place. Apparently was a nice guy. Didn't understand the business he was in. And it's a shame. It's a shame.
Well, I think a lot of people maybe didn't understand the business they were in. There's a quote, another quote here from you from the Nitro book. WCW's popularity was great, but there were some great stars that came out of there, but it maybe got bigger than it ever should have been. In fact, the guy that I worked for, a corporate controller, counseled me on this. He said, you don't want to be working so closely with wrestling because it's going to damage your career. And I said, wait a minute, how does that damage my career if I help these guys make money? He said, everybody hates it. Doesn't matter if WCW makes money or not, they hate it. And of course, you even were quoted in this guy Evans interview as saying, I know there's a school of thought that says if only the suits knew, given the rights fees that wrestling gets today, that maybe they would have stuck with WCW. No, wrestling had to go. Their deal wasn't based on rational thought about the audience or the numbers or what was possible. It was simply, no, we don't like it.
We don't like it.
That's just amazing. How much of that do you think was accelerated with the AOL Time Warner merger?
Oh, no, this was going on before the AOL.
Okay.
This was going way before that.
Okay.
This was, and I was counseled by Jack a number of different times. Don't even imply that you like it. Don't even imply that you know what's going on there. So the times that I opened my mouth about it was like when I told you earlier, screaming at Terry McGuirk about there are a lot of Pentium chips out there in those trailer parks.
Yes.
Based on the hits we're getting on the, we had two websites then for the NWO and the
WCW.
Also, and they were. I mean, people were all over that. That was great. That was great. And they just didn't appreciate it. You know, this And what that told me was that people like McGurk really didn't understand his business. But you got, here's the funny damn thing about, you know, this is a funny place. But when Ted first bought the Braves, he had to have his own man inside the Braves, you know, have his own man. So what he did was he signed Terry McGurk as a relief pitcher and sent him to Braves camp. He had been a ball player when he was in Marymount College or whatever the hell it was. You know, I mean, didn't even have university, Marymount College or whatever it was he went to. And he probably could have been adequate as a single A ball player. I don't know. But he went down there as a baseball player to the Braves so that Terry McGurk would have history as a ball player. Now he's now the president of the Braves. So that's funny, huh?
What a crazy story.
Yeah, you're right. It's crazy.
So what ultimately led to your departure from the Turner organization, and when was that?
I left in the year 2000, and I was pretty much run out of there. I was too old. I was 53 then, and that was twice as old as the oldest person that worked for me.
Wow.
And they were, I think they were pretty tired of me telling them the way things really were.
Right.
And I was tired of telling them too. So, but yeah, here's the good news about it. If you get run off, it can be a great thing. They gave me more money to go away than you can imagine. When that means that you're being run off, not because you did anything wrong, except piss them off.
Right.
And I guess I'd had all, I couldn't stand anymore. I couldn't stand any more of it. It was listening to some of that. But I, you know, the thing is, I believed in wrestling.
Yeah.
I believed in it. You know, again, that goes back 50 years to the Houston County Farm Center.
That's right. Absolutely.
But things like that picture, you know, for example, of the barbershop, you know, the
beauty of nature, the Ric Flair poster we talked about before we clicked record.
Yeah, the beauty of nature. Yeah. Damn right. And the stink they made about that.
So we'll throw up the poster so everybody watching along can have a reference for this poster. But I think you were telling Evan about it before we clicked record, and I sort of put two and two together, and I said, "Hey, I actually have that poster. I think it's one of the most rare Ric Flair posters of all time." And you told me the story. You told me the story of how upset some folks in the office were. Can you share that with everybody?
Yeah, it came out of the HR, and it had to do with the guy named, who's a controller before Don Edwards over there, a guy named Brian Mitchell's, great guy, Marine, you know, he's a type A type, he's a great guy, and he's the only kind of controller who could have gotten by in those days working in wrestling, because he could probably kick most of their ass. He was a great guy. And he said, "Look, I'm catching all this shit about this picture. I have to get rid of it. HR is making me get rid of it." And I said, "Okay, don't throw it away. It's too good a picture." He just take it. And I put it in my office, you know, looked good to me. And that's when the complaint started. And I said, what are you complaining about? What's the complaint? HR is coming to me now. And I said, "Well, what's wrong with it?" And the implication is that it implies that it takes three women to satisfy one man. I said, I'm not sure where you see that. I see some happy people.
It's a guy sitting in a barber chair holding a mirror. It's crazy that this is a conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's, yeah. There are three drop dead gorgeous girls hanging around Rick. And what better place for him to be?
my goodness.
But that was the kind of crap that went on there. And it's like HR had nothing better to do than to try to make a big deal out of that. And I said, okay. They said, just get it out of here. Get it out of here. And I said, okay, I took it home. So this is why it's upstairs.
It's amazing to me that that's even a conversation, but that was the Turner organization. Let's do some word associations with some folks that I know you worked with over the years. Mean Gene Okerlund. You get to meet Mean Gene.
I love that guy. That's the funniest guy I've ever met. He and
Bobby Heenan.
He and Bobby. Yeah, I used to run with them whenever I was possible to be around them. They were the funniest people I've ever met, and I loved them both. Absolutely loved them. And this is something you don't know. I don't think it's in the book. The night I proposed to my wife, we went down to a little restaurant in CM Center, Bugatti's. It was a good restaurant, and I took my wife down there to buy her dinner. And I walk in the bar down there is Okerlund and Heenan. You know, I knew them all the time from drinking after shows. You know, at Center Stage, and I walk in. And I said, "You introduce Pam to him." And Pam, these are a couple of guys I work with, and Gene Okerlund, Bobby Heenan. But she's kind of proper, and she starts talking to Bobby. And I said, do you live here? He said, no, I'm down in Florida. He said, well, what are you up here? So doing voiceovers, you know, for the show that airs this coming Saturday night. And he said, well, you're away from home. How do you entertain yourself when you're in Atlanta? And Bobby looks at his straight face. He says, well, the first thing I do when I get in to stay here in the Omni Hotel, first thing I do is I get my toolbox out. And I was staying in a double room. And I get my toolbox out, and I take the mirrors off the wall, and I put them down on the floor between the two beds. And then I take off all my clothes, and I jump back and forth from bed to bed, naked, over the mirrors. And it's just straight. And on the way to the car that night, Pam says, "Why do you like these guys? What's wrong with these people?" I said, "Well, you know, they were pulling your leg, and this is you got to understand." and that's the way those guys were. That's the way those guys were, and they were. They never stopped. Those right. guys were they didn't. We were. You probably don't remember the way it was, but in those days, World Championship Wrestling was on the 12th floor of the South Tower, and that's also where World Travel was. And there was a rented space, the World Travel up there, and they had about 30 people on phones handling, you know. Handling bookings, travels. Well, I'm walking down the hall with Okerlund from the elevators back down the hall toward WCW. We're just yakking away about what's up. And then all of a sudden, Okerlund peels off and heads into World Travel and says, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here from corporate, and I'm sorry to bring you this news, but we're closing this office. You're all been terminated, and personnel will be here momentarily with your packages. Sorry this has come this way. There won't be any severances, but I wish you the best." And then turns around and walks out. And I'm sorry, Gene, it's fun to do that every now and then. And he fired everybody in there. Most of them were, you know, people who couldn't have done the job more than 3 months. And then it's like it never happened.
Right.
You know, Okerlund says, "Hit them back down the hall. You got to have a prank on somebody else." That's the thing I liked about those guys. It was a joke. Everything was hilarious. That's about as funny as to me. That cracked me up. But that's about as funny as the story that Greg Gagne and Bill Dundee told me. And this was a funny story. This was the night of Slamboree 93.
Okay.
It's a pay-per-view we had at CNN Center. It was a great deal. All
the legends.
Yeah, they were all there. And some, you know, I hate to admit there's things I don't know, but there are things I didn't know. And they had me at a table. It was a dinner, you know, 10 people at a table, one wrestler and everything. And the guy that was at my table, I had never seen work. It was Don Morocco. And he's a great guy. He's a great guy. But at any rate, we had a good time. But we're waiting to go up into the dining room, talking to Dundee and Gagne. And they were telling me this story about Colonel Parker. You remember Colonel Parker? I can tell you his real name. Robert Fuller. He was the manager for...
Colonel Robert Parker.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he was the manager for Harlem Heat.
Okay,
and they brought him in originally though to manage Hammer. What's his name?
Van Hammer.
Van Hammer. Yeah, he was brought in to manage him. But the story, and this came from Gagne and
Bill Dundee.
You know, they needle everybody all the time anyway, and they were telling this story when they were down in Columbus. And this was at the same time where Missy Hyatt was involved in a lawsuit for something with him because Missy just saw a chance to make a buck, I guess. And she, what was it she claimed? She claimed that Ted Turner had harassed her. And what the quote was, it was a photo shoot. Jay Stoll was doing a photo show. Photoshop. He was a great photographer, by the way. You've probably seen a lot of his work, but he was a photographer for WCW for a long time. Great guy. He's the guy that took that picture of Sting and Sting. You've probably seen that
shot.
So he's just took that picture. Well, they were down in the back room, for a photo shoot, and Ted was saying something to Missy, like, "Hey, maybe you and I should wrestle some. We should mud wrestle." You know, Ted being Ted. And showed up later. Somebody said, "You ought to sue him for that." And of course, she did. She may have joked about it, but she didn't really start anything with that. Well, they're back in the locker room for this event in Columbus. And Jim Barnett starts this stuff with Missy about, no, Colonel Parker has a huge unit, and you probably ought to go ahead and ask him about it, sending Missy up to some shit, you know, because Missy she was involved in stuff like that all the time. In fact, when she quit us, I'm just saying, well, where are you going? She said, "I'm going to Philadelphia because there are four professional hockey teams within an hour's drive of there. And I love fucking hockey players." I said, "God." And I said, "Okay." I said, "But you know, just to save you a lot of driving, there are, in these two buildings, there are 700 accountants, and you know, you can have any of them you want." And she then tore, and we were down in that restaurant downstairs, and she starts screaming, "I wasn't fucking accounting it as the last man." So I said, "Look, I'm just needling you with it." So she starts in on Jim Barnett about the Colonel Parker.
Okay.
And so the boys, Greg and Dundee, decided, "Hey, there's a joke here," and so they started messing with Colonel Parker about this. You know, all these lawsuits going around about sexual harassment, and your name. I don't know if you know about this, but your name came up, and he said, "What are you talking about? What are you talking about?" "Well, you know, Missy and how you know, how you're hung and everything. He said, but I didn't show her anything. And he said, no, well, the story, and I've seen the papers. They're both claimed to have seen the legal papers that Colonel Parker, he was being charged with pulling his dick out in Columbus to show Missy. Now, this is bad because Parker didn't need this. He's just now decided to get squared back up with Baby because they've been broken up for a while. And he doesn't need any of this stuff coming back, especially if he's being sued. You know, this is looking bad for Parker. It's a great jerk. This is, and so they decide to start, how can we proceed with this? And they start working on Parker. You know, we've seen the paperwork, and I don't know how you're going to get out of this. And now he's really worked up. And he's in doing his voiceovers, too. And he's down in the downstairs sound suite where they did all the post-production work. And when Parker would come over to CNN Center, he would always be in, you know, he'd be in that white suit, that costume that he wore all the time. And he's down there sweating bullets because he said he's just got to come. He's got to come to, he's got to get leveled up so he's protected. And he decides this is the day I'm going to confront it right now. And he goes up to the 14th floor north. And this is where Ted's office is. And he's got a shitload of people from AOL in there now. And they're going through a lot of stuff. And Parker walks in. He's got to just pushes his way into the office with all these guys. Don't know who anybody in the room is. But he comes and says, Mr. Turner, I don't know what she told you, but I did not show her my dick. Now that's a hell of a way to. I know. And they said, well, look, we're having a meeting right now. I could just go out. And he said, I want to get this straightened out right now. And this is a Bill Dundee and Greg Gagne prank. It's as good as I've ever heard.
My goodness.
They straightened it out. Ted, who was that guy?
My goodness.
Yeah, you know, the name Missy Hyde. Because she was always trouble. So anyway, so.
You have any interesting stories about our pal Tony Schiavone?
No, I like Tony, but I never heard anything bad about him. I always thought he was a nice guy.
You spend any time with Randy Savage or Hulk Hogan?
I did. In fact, yeah, I've got a Savage really talked that way. You know, I used to run into him in the gym at CNN Center all the time, and I kept saying, "Shit, that's really him." He's always, oh yeah, you're doing other stuff all the time. God damn it. He's talking like a human for crying out loud. But one of the best stories about Hogan, you know, right after he came to us, Eric decided, I worked with Eric to see, I think it's a good idea for us to try to bridge some gaps between wrestling and entertainment. Why don't we just, and this was the show we introduced him at Center Stage. And that's where we had him paired up with,
I think Mean Gene introduced him there on, WCW Saturday Night.
That was, yeah, it was all this from that show. And that's what we had, one of the best, she had been Savage's manager too.
Sherry Martel.
That's her.
Yeah.
And the greatest ever. The yes. greatest.
Yes.
Best ever. A set it up deal where Eric and I would get, but we said, let's get her over there. She hates wrestling, and she's now sitting on top of our main product. We got to have her supporting us. So let's, Vicki Miller, let's get Vicki Miller to come over here, and let's get Hogan and, it's sort of a reception for Hogan and entertainment, right? And we went over there, and it was and Hogan's good. He's smooth, and and my kids with me. It was Vicki Miller and Eric and Jimmy Hart, Hogan and kids. It was a great experience. And Hogan was just great with my kids, and a really nice fellow. I've heard bad things about him, but I just thought he was a great guy. And I can understand why he was on top of the business for as long as he was. He's a real charmer. And in fact, I'll find it somewhere, probably on my damn phone. I'll send you the picture of Eric and Hogan and Vicki Miller.
Oh, wow.
And I also have a picture of my kids with him. And then, he was just very nice. He was very nice to my kids, as was Johnny B. Dad. Nicest person. Just great guys. But I'll send you that picture of Vicki. And she didn't like the business. In fact, she was one of the people that made the picture about, we don't need wrestling. We need to get rid of them because we've got the MGM library over here. It didn't cost us anything to run. You know?
Right.
We can run that over and over again. We don't need these wrestlers.
But talk to me about Sharon Sadello, another woman's name that comes up a lot when we talk about WCW. And she's credited with being the person who greenlit some of these little WCW mini movies that allegedly cost a lot of money and maybe were a little hokey. What was your experience like with Sharon, and were you involved in approving some of those expenditures?
No, I didn't know. I was not involved in any of that stuff. You mean like Thunder in Paradise or
the little person on a boat and they blew it up, and then Vader and Sting had lasers shooting out of each other's eyes, and there was a White Castle of Fear and silly stuff.
That was the, it was a 20 minute long video, and it was done to promote Bash at the Beach.
Yes.
And she may have, I didn't think it was a bad idea. It was like a mini movie.
Yes.
As a promo for Bash at the Beach.
Yes.
And yeah, that was it. And that was Shaw. Shaw is a funny guy, because that's when they, in the video is where they mentioned Cheatham. That was when they were creating a fictitious name.
Yes.
Just to jerk me around.
Do you trust Cheatham to get the job done? Please, let me do it.
Yes.
And that's because we didn't have a character later called Cheatham.
So that was the little person named Cheatham.
Yeah, right? they were trying to imply that was him. Yeah.
You know, we've talked for a long time, but I mean, the idea that your last name is Cheatham and you were an accountant, yeah, isn't that the most old school accounting joke of all time? Like Dewey Cheatham and Hal?
You know, it's funny because when I worked at Commerce Union, I worked with two other guys. And one was Dave Howe and the other was Dewey. and we were always drinking together. And it was sort of a running joke. Yeah, that's
my goodness gracious. The oldest accounting joke in the book. There it is.
Yeah. But I didn't know much about Sharon.
Yeah.
Except I thought she was a nice person.
What was your impression of Bill Watts?
I got there, I think, the week and a half before they shit canned him.
I got you.
And that was about the time where everybody was trying to get rid of wrestling. And that was just one more reason.
Because
Watts had always had a pistol in his boot, you know, and HR went after him on the basis of having a gun on the property. And they, God damn it, we'll do anything to get rid of anybody.
Yes, we will.
So, but I'd say I had a lot of respect for Bill Watts. I didn't know him, but from the wrestling business. I mean, he had, and we even had one of his kids, Eric Watts, worked for us as a wrestling.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And he's still around somewhere, but I
don't think he's doing much in wrestling these days, but somehow, some way, Sting still is. Any experiences with Sting you can tell us about?
No, I don't have any experiences with him. He didn't seem like he didn't seem open to conversation. Let me just say it that way.
Understood.
But I think he was an okay guy. I think he was an okay guy.
Somebody who was open to conversation, Mr. Ric Flair. You got any good Ric Flair stories you can share with us?
Well, yeah, but there's no, I have to be cautious about that. You know, he was.
He had a lot of fun.
He's the best, and he's. I'll tell you, if there's another human being that I could compare him to, and I don't know, you might know who this guy is. But there was a guy, a promoter, big promoter out of Tennessee, a guy named John J. Hooker. I don't know if you remember him.
No.
He was a businessman of sorts. He was mixed up with STP. He was mixed up with Mini Pearl Fried Chicken. He was always in some kind of a business that needed a promoter, you know. And he was, his last business that I know of was Hooker's Hamburgers. It was a drive, you could drive in. It was a long trailer. And you drive up to the first window and order hamburgers and beer. And then you just drive right through just and keep moving. But he was a promoter, and he was, you know, he was lying to you. You knew it. But, and everybody who talked to him knew that he was lying to you. But you still liked him. You know, you wanted to be around him. It didn't matter. He was going to take your money. You knew that. But, Rick has a lot of that in him. You like him. You don't care if he's going to steal your money. You know, you don't care because you like him. And it's a pleasure to be swindled by Rick Flair. You know?
My goodness.
But you know.
What a compliment.
I know, but Rick would tell you that he would lie to you when the truth would do better. And you don't mind, you know. And he was, I still love him, you know.
Everybody he's just the does. Greatest. Yes.
He's your dad and all, right?
Yeah, he is. Yes, sir.
Well, that's great. I'll, there's nobody like him.
No, there's not.
And no. I would have been willing to pay $1,000 to see him take a swing at Eric, you know. that period of time. Let me write the check right here.
I love
because
it.
Because Eric, there were a lot of good things about Eric. Lots of good things. A lot of shit I never would put up with. But there were times when Eric, I think, could have deserved a swing.
Yeah.
From Rick. Yeah. I'm just like I was when I see Eric involved in screaming fights with the dirt sheet guys. I kept thinking, this is not a confrontation you want. This you can use this guy. He can get you anything you want. Just talk right to him. You know, so, but Eric the whole time I knew him, he never liked the dirt sheet guys. Never liked him. Not saying you should, but he had a hater. I've heard him talk. On your show with Meltzer, you know, has made a living for what 40 years in the dirt sheet business.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, I always.
I want to ask you about one more name, and then we'll wrap this one up. I greatly appreciate you spending all the time with us today that you have, but ultimately, a lot of people hear this name as the guy responsible for pulling the plug on WCW. He was a part of the Turner organization. I'm not sure if you spent any time with him, Jamie Kellner. Did you spend any time with him? What can you tell us about Jamie?
Oh, yeah. Wait a minute. He was the guy that came out of the West Coast, right? He was Paramount guy?
I'm not sure. And I think, he was with WB, and then before that, Fox.
Yeah, he's a Paramount. And he wasn't with us long. He was not with us long. He didn't like wrestling. He really didn't like much of anything. He didn't like Atlanta. And as part of his deal with us, was that he only had to spend 3 days a week in Atlanta. But he wanted to stay, his residence was going to be on the West Coast. And I'll tell you, all kinds of shit I picked up in the broad category of jobs nobody wants. And one of them that I had for a couple of years was purchasing, or you know, supplies, or whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And as part of our deal with Kellner, we had to buy him and his wife matching 700 series BMWs.
Oh, my.
And that was just for their use here in Atlanta. We also had to keep matching BMWs for those two on the West Coast. And the biggest shit fight that I've ever seen over no reason was his wife pissed because the leather upholstery in her Turner car didn't match her West Coast car.
Oh.
So we had to run back and forth to get her matching West Coast leather.
Yeah, but before we clicked record, I should tell everybody, you said that Harvey Schiller, if there was a Hall of Fame of assholes, he'd be a first ballot Hall of Famer.
He is that, yeah. Yeah, I could say that. And it gets back to little things like him hitting on my wife, you know, little things like that.
Oh.
You think, what the hell is wrong with you? You know, yeah. People don't do that.
Right.
Oh, but another thing, you know, you keep dusting off these old memories. And one of the things he'd like to do, because he was a pilot, he'd like to load up on an airplane and let's go scout out the arena we'll go up to New York and we'll go up there for to scout the hotel we're going to be at for the Summer Olympics back in 96, I guess. And he always, this is the kind of shit that you see with people who want to be a mogul, but don't have the money to back it up. Just want to have the accoutrements, but not be it. He had these two girls at that point that worked for him. And they had a job, and that was to go with him to these hotels that they were going to stay at on his plane. He'd fly up. And one of them, this is the crazy shit. One of them's job was to make sure the bedroom that he was going to have was just right. And then the left side of the bed would have a bowl of M&M peanuts. And the other girl was set up to play M&Ms on the other bedside table. This is insanity, right?
Yes.
That's insanity.
Yes.
Well, that's him. That's Harvey. And the funny thing about him, you don't see as much, but this typically goes along with assholes. And that is, there is a charm there, and you can see it. It's a God-given talent that if he wants to be liked, he can be. But if he just wants to be an asshole, he's better at that.
My goodness.
But he is. And the thing about him was that the thing about him, my wife just came through her heart and shell and frowned us. But the thing of, about him is there was a charm to him, you know. But here's the type of shit he would do. The guy over at TBS, I can't remember the guy's name. Nice guy, head of the station. Well, Harvey called him and said, "Come over here. You and I got to be working together. I need you to come over." Bill, I hadn't thought about this stuff in 20 years, but
not Shaw or Bush, but somebody else.
This was a TBS guy, not a staff guy.
Okay.
It's the TV station guy. It'll come to me, I promise. But he called him to come over and meet with him after he redecorated that, the 11th floor, and it looked like the inside of the Cincinnati Reds office. And, you know, it's done with not anything in the broadcast business. He called this guy over and had him sit in his anteroom for a half hour. Harvey wasn't doing anything. He just wanted to keep him waiting for half an hour just to let him know who the boss was.
Stupid.
Now, wait a minute. Is this not in the annual report for the asshole organization? This is the type of stunt that nobody does to another human being if you ever want to work with him.
Right.
You know? Why would you do that? Let him know who the boss is. That was Harvey. You know?
Yeah. Stupid.
That's the guy. And that's the guy.
What I enjoyed most about our time today is you could tell what a big wrestling fan you are and certainly were. But before we clicked record, you made the analogy and you said that you still watch independent wrestling and Yes. You go to as many shows as you can in the surrounding Atlanta area. And you made an analogy where you said that, you know, guys at that level, they're doing it really sort of for the love of the game. It's not necessarily for a big money contract. They're doing it because they love wrestling.
Yes, it is a quote from Paul Hemphill, his book about the heart of the game. And he'd written that book about the Braves. And that's what I always describe what I see there is people who are doing it because they're damn sure not doing it for the money. In minor league baseball, those guys are not even doing it for meal money. You know, right. But they do it because there's something about it that they can't live without it. They've got to be there. And that's why the indie stuff is so good because I talk to a lot of those guys, you know, about, you know, there's nobody there to talk to them, but there are people like me who want to know about them, you know, and the guys, you know, he's in pretty good physical shape. He doesn't have any, mic skills, but he'll learn it eventually. But you talk to him about where are you from? Well, I'm from Florida. I'm up here and still get a chance to talk to my mom every week and send her pictures and stuff like that. You know, this guy loves the business, loves what he's doing, and he's not making any money. And all you can do is hope for him. And some of these guys, like I mentioned, Hunter James to you, you know, that's a great guy. If you ever have a chance to see him, you need to see him. You know, he's good. He's got the build. He's got a good look to him. And he's got incredible mic skills. And you wouldn't figure, how do you know that, Dick? Well, I've seen him in the ring get into a fight with a guy in the audience. And, you know, and a guy can hit him over and over again about why you don't belong in a place like this, seeing talent like, you know, and just great, great mic skills. He can do ad libs and a fan in the ring for an hour. And he looks good. He looks. In fact, what I'll do, give me your email.
I've got him pulled up now on Cage Match right now. We'll spread the word. Yeah, he actually appeared on SmackDown last year in an enhancement role in August of last year. So yeah, we'll keep an eye out for Hunter James.
Yeah, he's great. I've seen him four or five times, and sometimes he'll wrestle. I've seen him like four times in a week. You know, he'll be in Covington one night, then he'll be in Monroe the next night. And a buddy of mine, who both of us are crippled now because I've got my cane. He and I both be going through foot surgery for the last year, and we'll go down there together, you know, lumbering in like a bunch of old men, and we have a chance to see him and get better and better and better. In the case of Hunter James, he's got to be at the next level. He's got to be at the next level. And, here's a couple you got to see.
Okay.
If you haven't seen them yet. The Renegades.
Okay.
I think they're sisters. And right. They don't wrestle girls. They wrestle tag team against men.
Okay.
And they are good. They, and they're in these little places. They're great. They're great. So if you have a chance to see the Renegades, take them in because they're doing men stuff. They throw punches like guys.
Wow.
You know, and they got all the physical stuff. They got a good look and they talk pretty good too. That's, you know, you got mic skills. You got to be physically fit and you got to be in a way you pull eyes towards you. And those girls were there.
Yeah, so I just checked it out. They were actually on AEW Dark last year. The Renegade Twins, there you go, right there out of Georgia. Yeah. Charlotte Renegade and Robin Renegade. We'll keep an eye Man, look at you doing a little scouting. I love that you're still a wrestling fan, and I can't wait to get together and hang out with you in real life. But man, thank you so much for the time. I don't know what I expected today, but I took 3 hours of your time and it just flew by. Thank you so much. I greatly
this is a pleasure meeting you and talking to you. I look forward to seeing you next weekend. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this and meeting you, having watched you on television.
Man, that's awesome. Thank you very much. I greatly appreciate it.
And you are filling an important role. So,
well, that's nice of you to say.
I'll see you. I'll be over there next Friday night, then, I guess. And we do it on Saturday.
We'll see you then, man. Looking forward to it.
Very good. Me too. Me too. This is going to be, is this a hard place to find?
Ladies and gentlemen, Dick Cheatham, thank you so much, sir. Greatly appreciate all the time today.
Hey, thanks very much, Conrad. Appreciate your time, and thanks for being in the business.
Thank you.